This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the suppressed 28 pages from the investigation of the 9/11 attacks are released.
Now we know for sure that several members of the Saudi Arabian government were involved in supporting the terrorist attacks. But you heard it first on this show when we interviewed Senator Bob Graham from Florida, who predicted that this is what the released documents would show.
We talk about my new book, I Have Nothing to Hide, and 20 other myths about surveillance and privacy.
We get a chance to interview our co-host, Heidi Boghossian, who has just written, I Have Nothing to Hide, and 20 other myths about surveillance and privacy. It's a great contribution to the movement.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, there's been a lot of news recently about the so-called 28 pages. And before we talk about what's contained in those pages, we should remind listeners that this refers to an entire section in the official report of the Joint Inquiry into Intelligence Community Activities before and after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. This is not the 9/11 Commission report. It's an 838-page report that came out in December 2002. And the section at issue is now declassified. It's called Finding, Discussion, and Narrative Regarding Certain Sensitive National Security Matters. What's in those 28 pages?
Sensitive, and how? Heidi, when we interviewed Florida U.S. Senator Bob Graham, he couldn't tell us directly what was in there. But what he said indirectly in our interview, and we're going to play this for our audience, what he said indirectly was this. He said that there were elements of the Saudi Arabian monarchy that were involved in financially supporting and giving help to several of the hijackers on 9/11. We have to ask ourselves, why was it that this report was suppressed for 14 years and then really downplayed when it came out? And I think the reasons are twofold. One is Saudi Arabia used to, not so much anymore, but used to be the main supplier of oil to the oil companies in the United States. And secondly, and now, and more importantly, I think, is that Saudi Arabia is one of the main purchasers of arms from American arms manufacturers. Just recently, they bought $40 billion worth of weapons, which, incidentally, they're using in Yemen to kill Yemeni civilians. So I think that the relationship with Saudi Arabia and the United States is a delicate one. Obama has nurtured that relationship. He just went over there last month, and I think the two things he talked to him about were arms sales and how they were going to handle the release of the 28 pages. So with that in mind, give a listen to our interview several months ago with Florida United States Senator Bob Graham.
Retired U.S. Senator Bob Graham from Florida is the former head of the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee. He's also the leading person trying to get President Obama to release to the public the suppressed 28 pages of the 9/11 report, which until now had been hidden. Senator Graham contends that the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabians, could not have pulled off the operation alone, and that in fact they were part of a support network involving the Saudi Arabian monarchy and government, which helped plan, pay for, and execute the complicated 9/11 plot. Senator Graham said otherwise it would have been impossible for them to accomplish this. Senator Graham has written the book called Intelligence Matters, the CIA, FBI, Saudi Arabia, and the Failure of America's War on Terror. It provides a candid insight to the workings of the U.S. in Saudi relations and their implications on U.S. foreign policy making as it pertains to the Middle East. Senator Graham, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
We'd like to start by just asking a bit about your background, where you grew up, what the influence of your father was, and what positions you hold in the U.S. Senate.
I grew up on a dairy farm about 25 miles northwest of Miami. I was very influenced by my surroundings, which were the Everglades, a passion of mine. I was very much influenced by my parents. My father was a very wise man. He was also a very high integrity person and had run and been elected to the Florida State Senate in order to be a factor in cleaning out some of the corruption which had afflicted South Florida during the post-World War or pre-World War II period. That was a significant influence on my subsequent decision to pursue a career in elective office, and I frequently used the examples and lessons that I had learned from my parents in various political decisions that I had to make.
Senator, you served on the 9/11 Commission when you were still in the Senate, and you've said in the past that you became disillusioned, and I wanted to ask you, why was that?
Well, I did not serve on the 9/11 Commission, which was a citizens' commission. I co-chaired, as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the joint inquiry of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees into 9/11, with particular focus on the role of the U.S. intelligence agencies. After we finished our inquiry, which was in December of 2002, the Citizens Commission accepted our voluminous materials that we had developed and an over 800-page report, and they commenced their investigation, which went beyond the Intelligence Committee to a number of other agencies, such as the role of the Federal Aviation Authority.
Senator, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi Arabians. Do you believe they could plan, pay for, and execute the complex plot of 9/11 involving hijacking of airplanes without external support?
Absolutely not. These 19 people, most of them did not speak English. Most of them had never been to the United States before. Most of them were not particularly well educated. That they could carry out a plot of this sophistication over a time period, which for some of them was 18 months, and avoid detection is implausible. That's the word that the chairs of the 9/11 Commission have used to describe this matter. It is implausible to me that the United States government, 15 years later, still clings to the position that these 19 people did in fact operate alone without any external support, and therefore their inquiries have, in my opinion, been very unnecessarily truncated, because they haven't gone into the question of who were the groups that supported the 9/11 hijackers, because they don't believe they exist. The U.S. government does not believe that an external support network exists.
And specifically, who do you believe that external support network consists of?
Primarily Saudis. As you stated, 15 of the 19 hijackers were themselves Saudi nationals with government involvement, were the primary funders of al-Qaeda and continue to be a primary funder, as Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said during her tenure, that the primary source of funding of terrorism was Saudi Arabia. And I also, Saudi Arabia has been the principal promoter of this extreme form of Islam called Wahhabism, where young people are taught intolerance, jihad, and encouraged to act out against non-believers, and therefore have provided a steady stream of fresh recruits to terrorist organizations, from al-Qaeda to now ISIS.
Senator, why do you think that the United States government ignored the warnings that something terrible was going to happen prior to 9/11. And then my next question is going to be, why haven't they been more forthright in discussing who might have done it afterwards? But let's talk about before 9/11. Isn't it true that the president gets a daily briefing, and mightn't he have been warned about this?
Yes, and he was. The 9/11 Commission developed the concept, it was a lack of imagination, that we knew significant amount about Al-Qaeda and about what its intentions were. They had tried to hijack airplanes in the Philippines several years before 9/11. They had been the primary operatives in the attacks on two U.S. embassies in Africa, so they were not an unknown adversary. But with all of that, we didn't have the imagination that they might be plotting to attack not thousands of miles away on another continent, but attack in the United States and use as the means of that attack the same technology, commercial airliners, that they had tried to use in the Philippines.
After the attack, there's 28 pages of the report that haven't been released. And I know that you're under constraints and can't talk about what's in those pages, but I know you've written a book called Keys to the Kingdom, which is a novel about that. And I wondered whether you might talk about the novel so we could try to understand what's been suppressed.
First, about the 28 pages. The final report that was submitted in December of 2002 was over 800 pages. One chapter of 28 pages was totally redacted, and that chapter has been publicly acknowledged as primarily dealing with who financed 9/11 and pointed a very strong finger at Saudi Arabia, not surprisingly. I wrote a book called Intelligence Matters, which is a nonfiction book about the before 9/11, during, and then the investigation afterwards. There was a significant amount of that book which was censured. I was frustrated by that, and while I was a senior fellow at the Kennedy School, one of the faculty members suggested that I could tell the stories that were excluded from the nonfiction Intelligence Matters by writing it as a novel. So that was the origin of Keys to the Kingdom. I say Intelligence Matters, ask the questions, and Keys to the Kingdom gives the answers.
Senator, tell us a bit about the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandor. Why did he get President Bush to allow over 100 persons to fly out of the U.S. right after 9/11, before they could be questioned?
He had a very personal relationship with the Bush administration and with President Bush himself. The Bush family has been close to the House of Saud going back to the grandfather, Prescott Bush. So when the ambassador called the White House in the hours immediately after 9/11 saying he wanted to meet with the president, he was accommodated. They met in the White House. Prince Bandor said that there were many elite Saudis in the United States. It happened that at that time in Kentucky, the horse sales were going on, and that had brought together not only Saudis who lived in the United States, but Saudis from around the world, and that he, Prince Bandor, was concerned that they were going to be harassed and asked the president for permission, even though most of American aviation was grounded at the time, if he could get a chartered plane to fly these Saudi elites back to their home in Saudi Arabia. The president agreed with that, and a few days later, after collecting Saudis elsewhere, chartered plane flew from Lexington, Kentucky to Saudi Arabia with approximately 145 elite Saudis, including members of Osama bin Laden's family, back to Riyadh.
Whoa. Let's talk about Osama bin Laden, if we might, Senator. Bin Laden was, of course, from one of the elite families in Saudi Arabia. And there's been speculation that he told the government that he was willing to cause civil unrest in that country, that he was unhappy about certain policies that the government was carrying out, particularly with respect to the United States. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, the background to that goes to the first Persian Gulf War, the one that was in 1990-91 when Iraq had invaded Kuwait. Bin Laden had just come off being a major factor in defeating the Russians in Afghanistan and had some 30,000 war-hardened veterans at his call. He went to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and said, I can protect the kingdom from Saddam Hussein. You don't need to call on the Europeans or the Americans. The king at that time rejected bin Laden's offer and, in fact, did invite the United States and the Europeans, who in the early period of 1991 routed the Iraqis from Kuwait. Bin Laden never forgot that slight. At some point later in the 1990s, when he had returned to Afghanistan and was beginning the planning for what became 9/11, he became aware that this was going to be a very complicated process. I mean, compare what happened in 9/11 to what happened in Paris recently. The complexity of hijacking multiple airlines at the same time, having people who were technically capable then of flying the airplanes, being able to identify the targets and hit them in a very compressed period of time, were daunting challenges. Bin Laden figured out that these 19 people, with their linguistic and cultural limitations, were unlikely to be able to do that, and so he went to the kingdom and said, we want your support. I'm not saying that he specifically told the Saudi royal family what his ultimate plan was, but that he was going to have representatives of Al-Qaeda in the United States, and they needed to have people who could assist them, provide financing, give them access to some of the services that they would need, such as flight training, and protect their anonymity, and that if the kingdom didn't do all of the above, he would unleash his 30,000 warriors and start a civil war in Saudi Arabia. The kingdom capitulated and made available to the bin Laden a network primarily based on people who had been representing Saudi Arabia surreptitiously in the United States to oversee young Saudis, college age principally, who the kingdom were concerned might be plotting against the kingdom in the same way that college students had overthrown the Shah of Iran. A complicated story, but bin Laden played the piano of all of these different people, histories, values, concerns very well, and the kingdom made available to him what he'd requested, and I don't think 9/11 would have happened but for that.
Is that the reason you think that this has all been covered up?
Why it's been covered up by the United States government is another mystery. It's easier to answer the question for the Bush administration. I mentioned earlier the close personal relationship that the Bush family had with the House of Saud. Oil was another consideration. When President Obama ran in 2008, he ran on a platform of opposition to the war in Iraq. There was a lot of expectation that he would reverse these policies of non-disclosure of information about 9/11. When he became president, and in fact, and I can't say this firsthand, but it's been reported that President Obama told some of the families of the victims of 9/11 that he would release these documents. And now, in his 8th year as president, it hasn't happened. I'm an optimist. I still hold out hope that before January 20th, 2017, that President Obama will deliver on that promise that he has allegedly made and make all this information available to let the American people know what's the nature of our relationship with Saudi Arabia and be part of the decision-making process as to what should we do about it.
Senator, what are you doing now to secure the release of the suppressed 28 pages?
Well, there are a number of things which I hope are going to contribute to President Obama deciding to release these. One of those is this considerable amount of media interest, which had been dormant up until about a year ago. Now there are regular stories and reports much in line with what we're talking about today. Also in the Congress, there is a resolution to ask the president to release specifically the 28 pages on who financed 9/11. I think there's growing pressure for a release, and I hope it'll reach critical mass in the next 12 months.
The government of Saudi Arabia has been sued on behalf of wrongful death suits on behalf of the family of people who were murdered in the towers. They put up a defense of sovereign immunity. Can you talk about that?
Yes. First, it's very interesting that they have used the defense of sovereign immunity not just to protect the kingdom, but to protect a whole series of charities, foundations, religious institutions, all of which have been alleged to have been involved in some phase of supporting the 9/11 hijackers, primarily financing. Then the Saudi government says, although we use sovereign immunity to protect all these groups from litigation in a U.S. court, we, the kingdom, we're not involved in any of these things, and therefore you can't sue us, right? You can't have it both ways. You can't say sovereign immunity applies to non-governmental groups and then say, but the government itself, which is using that defense, is immune. The status is that under the current law that governs suits against terrorist groups by U.S. citizens in U.S. courts, it's almost necessary to make your case beyond reasonable doubt before you can even get a hearing. And what has happened is that on several occasions, the families of 9/11 victims have been dismissed from court. And I'm sad to report the U.S. government has supported those dismissals. Now the second district in New York City has reversed at least one of those dismissals, and the case has been refiled, and it's working its way back through the system. And in Congress, there's an effort underway to change the law so that it's not so onerous, and plaintiffs representing persons who have been killed or otherwise adversely affected by terrorists can get their day in court. I hope that this Congress will pass that. It almost passed at the last Congress, and I am optimistic again that that the Congress that's seated today will make adjustments to the law so that it will be more rational for American citizens to find justice.
Senator Bob Graham, we're coming down to the end of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you if you have any final thoughts on this before we have to say goodbye.
Yes, maybe the most persuasive argument to Americans to keep all these materials disclosed is national security, that in some way it would have an adverse effect on our safety if this information were made public. I think it is absolutely the opposite, that the fact is that we have sent a message to Saudi Arabia that they can do anything with impunity, with absolute assurance that they will not be sanctioned, and that that fact of the message of impunity through the unwillingness to disclose information in the possession of the United States government about Saudi Arabia's action at 9/11 has encouraged Saudi Arabia to continue to support terrorist groups, now ISIS, and to continue madrasas and mosques, which shape the young minds of Muslims so that they are prepared and religiously motivated to want to fill the ranks of ISIS or other terrorist organizations. So to me, our national security is being dramatically adversely affected by the way in which we have related to Saudi Arabia for its support for the 9/11 hijackers. I think it's an outrage, and I hope that the Obama administration will not leave this as their legacy.
Senator Bob Graham, it's really been an honor for us to have a person with your intelligence and courage on Law and Disorder, and we thank you so much for being our guest.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your carrying this message to the people of America.
Thank you, Senator.
Best of luck.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We're going to turn the tables on you. You're not only my co-host, but you're also the subject of this interview because you've written a terrific book called I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Surveillance and Privacy. And Let's talk about the book, Heidi. I want to congratulate you. You really did a good job. Why
Thank
the title?
You.
I've Got Nothing to Hide. You're very welcome. Why the title, I've Got Nothing to Hide, and 20 other myths about surveillance and privacy? Do people really not get it? Do they really think they've got nothing to fear?
Michael, this is one of the most frequently heard myths when the topic of surveillance arises. I think it's a variation of the larger tensions between individual rights and national security. So those who say they have nothing to hide seem to be oblivious to the dangers that omnipresent surveillance poses to our individual liberties. Once we turn on the faucet for mass monitoring, it's not something we can easily turn back off. I think it's a rather facile response by individuals who often see the world in black and white rather than in the nuanced gray tones that we live with. First, privacy is critical to our daily lives and also to society's smooth functioning. Public health, public welfare all depend on affording various levels of privacy. For example, to individuals who may be clinically depressed and contemplating suicide. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline, as our listeners probably know, lets callers be anonymous, and it receives somewhere between 2 million calls annually, which no doubt are saving many lives. The same goes for keeping things like HIV status private. People may be discouraged from getting tested if they have to give their name, so testing can now be done confidentially or anonymously. But Michael, think about whistleblowers. We rely on anonymous tips to report official malfeasance, waste, abuse. The government in many states have hotlines where you can share tips anonymously. And in New York City, for example, we have a Crime Stoppers hotline that doesn't trace or record calls or ask for names. I think in a larger sense, everyone needs privacy to remain autonomous. And that means we get to decide what and when we reveal information about ourselves that we want to keep private to others. It's a choice. I think finally, people who believe this myth have blind faith in state and corporate powers. But we especially on Law and Disorder have seen how federal agencies and their corporate partners cannot be trusted to operate in good faith. They have a lackluster track record in safeguarding our personal data from hackers. That's often because they don't take adequate measures to protect it in their databases. So massive data breaches have exposed millions of individuals unnecessarily, have exposed their private data, which then opens them up to fraud and identity theft. My takeaway for this myth is that people who adhere to it greatly underestimate the repressive power of the all-seeing state.
We're talking to our own Heidi Boghossian. For those of you that have tuned in late, we're talking about Heidi's new book. It's called I Have Nothing to Hide and 20 Other Myths About Our Surveillance and Privacy. Heidi, before I tell people how they can get the book, I wanted to ask you one follow-up question. Please tell us about the nature and the extent of surveillance by the government and corporations and our lack of privacy. How widespread is this?
Well, the Washington Post did an investigation a few years back that revealed that nearly 2,000 private security companies and over 1,200 government organizations or agencies engage in counterterrorism intelligence gathering. Now, that was several years ago, so I'm sure those numbers have greatly expanded. We also know that corporations who may not be solely in the practice of counterterrorism intelligence gathering often have their own security arms where, with activists, for example, who may be critical of their policies, they have engaged in surveillance, monitoring, and in certain circumstances, even infiltrating activist organizations. I think SeaWorld a couple of years ago was infiltrated to spy on people and often subvert the investigations that these groups are trying to uncover. So it's a massive operation, and people should know that we learned with Ed Snowden revelations that something like 80% of our government intelligence is outsourced to private security companies. The problem, as you know, Michael, is that they don't have to abide by the strictures of the U.S. Constitution. So they're not looking out for our interests to the extent that our government, when it does so.
Heidi, do you think that surveillance makes us safer?
Most definitely not. This is one of the more popular myths. It comes up every time there's a criminal attack or some kind of national security event where the public starts to get on edge. The government uses it to frighten the public into accepting widespread and pervasive spying. But Michael, I cite an unlikely source because I thought it was so compelling, and that is the U.S. Army War College. Because in one of the reports that they wrote, here's a short quote from it, they say, U.S. efforts in the war on terror have been largely ineffective in achieving the stated objectives. Their report also says there's no proof that those people who claim that because another attack like 9/11 hasn't happened, well, that's proof that the war on terror has been a success. I think this is a handy line that the government doles out to encourage people to not mind giving up their personal privacy, their civil liberties, because they think, well, I'm doing this to make our nation safer. And there's no evidence. I cite some other sources, but there's absolutely no evidence that it has made any impact in making us safer. And I also think we need to underscore the fact that you do not have to give up civil liberties in order to have national security. We can strike a balance. It's not one or the other.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things that you write about in your book, Heidi. In I Have Nothing to Hide, you talk about police monitoring social media, and you talk about biometric technology so that they have face recognition technology that can tell who we are. Talk about the police on social media, and they're using biotechnology and biometrics.
Well, police monitoring social media is, when you really think about it, a very cost-effective and relatively easy way for law enforcement to follow certain individuals or groups of people to look for what they are going to say are tips that criminal activity may be afoot. It's easy because many people don't set the privacy settings on their accounts, so a lot of people can go on and read them. Now, the problem with this is because we communicate so very differently on social media, informally, with colloquial language, shorthand, slang, law enforcement can easily misinterpret the things that are posted there. Not only can they misinterpret them, but if they really want to open an investigation, they can sort of position sayings like that either by taking part of a quotation, part of a text, and using it in a way that fits with their agenda, thus enabling them to open an investigation. Now, Michael, you may remember that several years ago in the Bronx, in a public housing project, police monitored social media of teenagers who were friends with each other, and they lived in the same building or set of buildings right near each other. So they hung out together. Police monitored their social media and then went in and raided 100 or so of them and arrested these kids on racketeering, RICO charges, traditionally used, as you know, for, you know, organized crime. And they arrested them, I think, on drug-related charges, when in fact most of the kids were just communicating through social media with their neighbors and friends. And the problem with that is that a lot of these kids couldn't afford defense attorneys, and many of them did get, as I recall, public defenders. But RICO charges are notoriously difficult to prosecute. So what happened was you had a guilt by association situation stemming initially from culling social media and then using it to fit the larger RICO charges, which really devastated and ruined the lives, not only of many of these kids who were run through the criminal justice system for often years at a time, but their families and communities. That's just one example of how misinterpreting communications on social media by third parties who don't really know who these people are can have disastrous consequences. And in terms of biometrics, as you mentioned, biometric identification, as we've covered on Law and Disorder, we interviewed Claire Garvey from Georgetown University. Biometrics use physical or behavioral characteristics that are unique to an individual human being to authenticate that person's identity. So I could take, if I were a cop, for example, your finger or palm print, or Michael, your iris or retina scan, even your ear print, your heartbeat, your facial recognition, your DNA, or your brain waves, and put those in the database and retrieve them whenever I want to. And as we covered in that segment that we did, and I encourage listeners to pull up Claire Garvey because she's so intelligent on this and one of the leading experts in the country, something like half of the country, the faces of half of our populace are stored in police databases already. They get them from public cameras all over, you know, mugshots, social media, other places. Now, behavioral biometrics, on the other hand, are things like our voice, our gait, even our eye blinking and speech patterns, how we hold the grip on a steering wheel, our signatures, even how we type on a computer. None of these are foolproof by any means, but they are growing in use. And I think that the myth here is many people believe they're foolproof. They can be hacked, the databases that they're in. In the chapter that I have on biometrics, I start with an example of researchers who made face masks from facial imprints. They use those masks in different airports and places around the world, and they tricked the cameras that read the biometric identification. So they're not foolproof, and I suggest, as others have, that if biometrics are going to be used to be safe, they must, and to be accurate, they must be paired with another form of identification or authentication. But the fact is, they can be altered, they can be stolen from photos, and once they're hacked or stolen, this is the one part of our identification that you can't replace like a password. So it's all the more reason they need to be highly protected if they're even going to be used.
Yeah, it's plenty creepy. It struck me, I went to the cardiologist last year, and I was driving home from the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, and they take a picture of you when you drive through the tunnel. And it dawned on me that the cops are going to know more about the condition of my heart than I do. And before I even get home, they're going to know all of that. So it's scary.
I'm sure the last time you went to the hospital for some kind of checkup or test, I know that I was offered, I think it was at New York Hospital, the option of signing in person or using a handprint, I think it was. And they've been doing this for a couple of years, right? I hope you didn't pick the handprint.
I resisted, and the doctor said, don't give them a hard time. And I said, but this is me, and I don't want to do it.
And that goes to the heart of what we're faced with. We're facing increasingly a trade-off between convenience, expedience, and personal security. I know that you're curious about whether our phones can spy on us, and of course the answer is yes. But we've gotten so used to using our phones for everything that we do during the day and carrying them in our pockets. But they're perfect surveillance devices. And I think the problem is when these biometric technologies start seeping into everyday places like hospitals or businesses, banks, they have to give us an option to opt out of that, I hope, because otherwise we're totally connected to the surveillance apparatus.
Let me just inform our listeners about one of your fans, Allison Macrina, who's the director of the Library Freedom Project. We had her on as a guest, and she says about your book, "The first time I opened this book, I audibly squealed in delight. The persistent privacy myths that Boghossian exposes are the torment of every privacy advocate's existence. She eviscerates each one with style, melding important tech and policy history with personal stories and current events. This book is for anyone who wants to lay to rest the most persistent and damaging myth that we should give up our privacy altogether." Allison Macrina. Congratulations, Heidi, to elicit a blurb on the back of your book from somebody that prestigious is really laudatory.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Let's talk about not just cell phones, but the other gadgets that people have in their home, like Alexa. What can those things do to us?
Okay, don't get me started on the evil Alexa, Michael. She is my enemy. But before we talk about smart homes that include things like Alexa, I want to just add, on the topic of Allison, when we interviewed her several years ago, and I have a chapter in my book on this topic, one of the things we discussed was a small library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, which happens to be just a few miles from the town in New Hampshire where I grew up, Hanover. They installed in their library Tor. It's called the Onion Router, and it's what many people will know as software that anonymizes your search activities online. And Chuck McAndrew, who I quote in the book and tell his story, came to that library several years ago, and that was one of the first things that he did to ensure that patrons who are surfing the web are able to do so without anyone being government actors or corporate entities, being able to search what people had looked for online. And I give the example for teenagers who are maybe curious about sex or, you know, like venereal diseases or embarrassing topics. They, you know, may not want to ask a friend or haven't yet asked their parents. They can go online and look for it. Well, they don't want to have that a trail left of what they've been investigating online. And what happened was after Chuck installed this at Kilton Library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, the Department of Homeland Security got wind of it. And they came up, they paid Chuck and his boss a visit and said their usual line of, "Do you want to grease the wheels of lawlessness?" Because, as you know, Michael, we've covered this a lot in discussions about hackers and Julian Assange, whistleblowers who use anonymizing software like Tor or SecureDrop. The government likes to portray anonymizing tools, even though they were the original creators of it, as shady characters dealing on the dark web who were trying to engage in illegal activity, when in fact that's very far from the truth. So they frightened the administrators at the library, and the board of trustees caved and removed Tor. But then there was great community outrage. People were protesting on the lawn, and Vermonters and New Hampshireites, you know, converged, and they reinstated Tor. Now, this sounds like a really small measure, and it was certainly a small library where this happened, but it was a huge victory for recognizing that this nation has a history of appreciating the ability to engage in anonymous speech. And I just say bravo to Allison and the Library Freedom Project supported Chuck McAndrew and that library, and kudos to their work.
Let me get to a heavy question here. What can we do to take action and demand that federal agencies and corporations guard our privacy and help reclaim control of our data?
Michael, it's not an easy question to answer. I want to first say that we need to raise general awareness of how the government with corporations really are a double-headed hydra when it comes to surveillance. In the book, I call them, I call corporations butlers to the billionaires. They really perform the dirty work of the 1%. They help maintain power among the richest and the most privileged in our society. As we mentioned, our intelligence is outsourced to private contractors, and personal data is the new commodity. It's more valuable than oil. That means every corporation is out to get your personal data. They aggregate it, they resell it to others, to marketers, and then ads are directed at you. As you know, when you're online and you search for a pair of shoes, all of a sudden you have shoes coming at you from all angles. People need to know that if you don't start being discerning about your privacy settings, how you handle your own electronic hygiene, you're stashing your crown jewels in a cheap motel safe, and you're leaving the code on a post-it in plain sight.
How does this impact democracy? And do people really act differently if they know they're being spied on?
Well, yes. I cite several studies, many of them in Great Britain, that show that when we know we're being watched, and it doesn't have to be high-tech surveillance, something as simple as a poster that has two large eyes, even just drawn onto it, in one study was posted in a coffee room at a university in Great Britain where they had the honor system. So you could make your coffee and then leave money in the pot. And when they posted a sign with two large eyes on it looking directly at you as you face the coffee pot, they found that people left more money. They alternated weeks and put a bowl of flowers on the sign. And on the flower weeks, people tended to be less generous with their donations. Another interesting study was with kids who were trick-or-treating, where mirrors were put up in half of the trick-or-treaters' houses. And they left bowls of candy in front of the mirrors, and there were no people guarding them. So kids could open the door. And of course, in the ones without mirrors, they took handfuls of candy. But in the homes where they knew that they were being reflected in a mirror, not necessarily watched, they felt guilty, and they curbed their enthusiasm, as it were, and took less candy. Now, there have also been other studies, especially after the events of 9/11, after the Edward Snowden revelations, that monitor how people communicate on social media. And when people have increased awareness, for example, that the NSA may be gathering their data, their metadata, they change their language. They don't use trigger words like bomb or attacks or other words that might raise suspicion.
I thank you very much for your great work on the book, and thank you for the interview.
Michael, thank you so much for reading my book and for taking the time to have me on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you.